Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that war rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax, presented to you this week by Rabbit Who Fights. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims. With me, as always, Liquid Rage himself, Matt Wilson. Matt, you raging tonight?
Not tonight. Yesterday, Wednesday, the day before we were recording this episode, I did do a taste test on the Blair's Megadeth sauce with Liquid Rage that you gave me for my birthday.
I did, indeed.
My pal Bobby came over with some wings from Buffalo Wild Wings.
Only the finest.
Only the
finest.
From
Matt Wilson.
And we put, not only did we put Megadeth sauce, we put other sauces on other wings to kind of work our way up to it in that hot one style. You know, the blueberry ghost pepper hot sauce, no big deal, right? Sriracha, free throw. Like, so much of it was, you know, I'm used to this. Then I put Blair's Megadeth Liquid Rage on a wing. I ate it. Bobby had not eaten his yet. He was looking at me. He's looking in my eyes. And he apparently, like, sees my eyes start to water as I'm eating it. Which, the first thing I said was, it actually tastes good. Because it does. And then my eyes start watering, and he's like, oh, no, it's bad. And I was like, brother, it's bad. I'll say this for Blair's Megadeth with Liquid Rage. It is the only hot sauce I have experienced through the entire digestive process.
Ooh. Yeah, you told me yesterday, you were like, it's inside me. Like, I can feel it in my stomach right now, which does not sound good.
Yeah. Like, everything else, just mouth burn. Blair's Megadeth with Liquid Rage.
Matt, do we
full body experience.
Matt, is this a hot sauce podcast now? What do we do on this show? I seem to have forgotten.
It is not a hot sauce podcast. I just wanted to update everybody from last week's show with the gift presentation. What we do on this show is we talk about comics, we talk about pop culture, we talk to comics creators, which we're going to be doing this week, as we talk to Katie Schenkel about Cardboard Kingdom. She is one of a handful of writers on that book, and all with one artist who does an amazing job. We're going to talk to her about her contribution to the book, about how the book came together, working with Chad Sell, the artist, lots of cool stuff. We're going to talk to her about all of that. But Chris, before we get to talk to Katie, we've got some stuff to take care of, starting with talking about our listener sponsor for the week.
That's right, Matt. Our listener sponsor this week is Rabbit Who Fights. It is a full-color, 24-page, one-man anthology by Tim Hamilton. Each issue features a lead story called Disciples 12 that is, I guess, of particular interest to me in this new phase in my life.
Uh-huh. In your Apocrypals phase.
It is about a savior-like super being who came to Earth in peace to help us, but we killed him and pretend he was fake news because he was bad for business. But he left behind a cult, 12 disciples, secret children, and disruptions in time and space. That story is the lead in every issue of Rabbit Who Fights, but each issue also has backup stories along with rejected New Yorker cartoons.
The lead story is a pretty, like, big cosmic, philosophical, religious kind of thing. Each issue is self-contained. They're not serialized, but they all exist in the same universe. And you've got the serious stories, and then you've also got backups, which are funnier. They're more humorous. So you got a little bit of everything in there. The book comes out twice a year. Three issues have already come out. So you can grab all three issues on Gumroad, on Tim's Gumroad site, which is gumroad.com/Tim Hamilton, RWF, that's RWF as in Rabbit Who Fights. So It's Tim Hamilton's name, RWF. That's where you can go check it out. There will be a link in the show notes on warrocketajax.com. The book is also available in a number of comic stores. So if you live near any of these, you can go grab the book. Anyone Comics, Comics Experience, Comics Revolution, Floating World, Hypnotronic, Maximum Distractions, Star Clipper, and Quimby's, a store that I loved in Chicago. So if you live near any of those stores, you can pick it up there, or you can pick it up on Tim's Gumroad site.
That's right, Matt. Tim did the right thing, kicking in a few dollars to us here on War Rocket Ajax. So now it's your turn to do the right thing and check out his stuff. What else do we have, Matt?
We also need to take a moment to thank our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who have taken some money, put it in the envelope, the digital envelope, if you will, and sent it on down to 408 Gimmick Street, where we're recording this episode tonight. And they do that by going to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kicking in as little as a dollar every month.
Here are some folks who have done that. Aviv Leo Zippin.
Thank you, Aviv.
And Jason Cruikshank.
Thank you, Jason.
You could be just like Aviv and Jason and help us out by going to patreon.com/warrocketajax, helping us out with as little as $1 a month. If you kick in a little bit of money for our Patreon, you could get ad-free episodes of the show. You could get bonus audio. I just posted the very last bit of bonus audio from our road trip in Ohio. So you could get every single piece of that if you kick in at that level. Line-stepping privileges for our list segments, physical rewards, other cool stuff. That is all available if you have to patreon.com/warrocketajax and help us out a little bit. All right, Chris, that is enough for business. Let's do some checks and recs.
Let's do it.
It's been a couple weeks since we've done a check. What do you have to check in with?
I got kind of a bummer this week. Usually, we try to make Warrocket Ajax a nice bummer-free zone where you can just listen to me and Matt talk about how much we love metal and the mantling. But I did want to talk about this a little bit. I'm a married man now, Matt. I got a family to think of. I got a wife.
That's true.
So I've been looking into getting life insurance lately. And I've been one company rejected me and did not tell me why. And then another company came back after my blood tests and my exam and everything and quoted me a price that is twice as high as I was that they had quoted me originally. That they had said, hey, you can get this policy for this amount, came back with twice as much because of the underwriter. Now, I've seen the results of the test. They put them online there. So I've had two recent blood tests and everything. I'm fine. I'm very healthy. In fact, it turns out, much to everyone's shock. But one of the things they do is they check about prescriptions that you might be on. And the only prescriptions that I'm on and the only thing that I can figure, since they were waiting specifically to hear back from my psychiatrist, was that I'm on medication for depression and anxiety. And I feel like that's a real bummer to get back from life insurance, because that's a thing that, you know, that's a problem I'm seeking treatment for. And that really hit me as a, you know, why even bother at this point, you know? But I am not going to let that get me down. I'm doing a lot better. Like, I've talked about this a little bit on the show before. Getting medication for those problems has really helped me out over the past year or so. And I'm doing fine. But that cheesed me off a little bit, I'm not going to lie.
I understand that. However, you might want to consider this. Perhaps the underwriter who quoted you the price for your life insurance policy went on the internet and searched for Christopher J. Sims.
I really hope that's not the case.
and saw that we have a snacks podcast.
So we have a snacks podcast, and that I literally said into a microphone, I could eat this cinnamon bread until I died from it.
I would not count out having a snacks podcast as a reason, a justifiable reason for doubling the cost of a life insurance policy.
Matt, I'm not the one over here experiencing liquid rage. I experience, like, personal rage daily, which is my problem.
Listen, what it says on the coffin that Blair's Megadeth sauce comes in is feel alive. And brother, I've never felt more alive.
All right, well, Matt, when you put it like that, maybe it is snack situation that's doing it. But yeah, life insurance, what a hassle. Matt, what are you up to this week?
Well, I feel like I've already given one check earlier in the show talking about trying Blair's Megadeth sauce with liquid rage.
Really going into detail.
I mean, I felt like I needed to follow up. I couldn't let it go without letting people know that I tried it. I got a whole bottle still. It's in the fridge. It expires in 2020. I got to have it a few more times between now and then.
What if you just chugged it right now?
But there wouldn't be a show anymore?
Like, at all?
For a while.
I think you'd be okay.
We definitely have to stop this episode. I don't know when I would be able to do it again.
Well, look, we've already recorded the interview. This is fine. Let's do it. Nobody cares what we think about the Spider-Man annual.
That's fair. The other check I wanted to bring up is I just wanted to let folks know that the second issue of Everything Will Be Okay is going to be on Comixology this Wednesday.
Hey.
June 27th. So if you picked up issue one or you haven't picked up any issues yet, you could grab issues one and two on Comixology this Wednesday. It's a good book, and people I know seem to like it. I handed out a lot of copies and sold some copies at Heroes Con, and I feel like the response to it was good. So if you haven't checked it out yet, issues one and two will be available on Comixology in 2 days on Wednesday of this week. So wanted to let people know about that. And that's pretty much it for me with checks. Chris, what is your recommendation for this week?
My recommendation, honestly, Matt, I was leveled after Heroes Con. So I have not been doing a lot this week.
It wiped me out pretty hard too, I gotta say.
Yeah, we did pick up some amazing stuff at the show. Andy Hirsch has a new comic out. We've talked to Andy about his super innovative things that he's done. Now he's got a book that he calls a Rashomon-style road trip, which is four different perspectives on a four-way stop that you can read individually or together. But he also recommended a comic that I'm very excited about checking out. I picked it up at Heroes Aren't Hard to Find after the show. It's called Bad Mask. And it was he said it was his favorite comic of last year. But I have not read that yet. What I have been doing is catching up on some television.
The Hobby of Champions.
I got two real quick, Rex. One is that I've been catching up on The Americans, which is a show set in 1983 about two Soviet spies who are undercover in America as Americans.
I've heard a lot about the show. I've never watched it.
It's very good. I like it. It's got incredible acting. The two leads have an incredible amount of chemistry together. Kerry Russell and Matt Reeves are the leads, and they're pretty fantastic. And I also like, following up on our conversation that we had a while back about Game of Thrones and Westworld, the opening sequence of this show is not that prestige TV bullshit that I hate. It's stylish. It actually has a theme song. It gets across the idea behind the show. Very good opening sequence. I'm about probably halfway through season two, and it's an incredibly good show. Love Martha. Martha's the best. Really excited about Martha. Matt, I suggest you catch up. I think you would find a lot to like. My other quick rec, I did watch NXT TakeOver, and it was the shit.
Extremely good show. Velveteen Dream and Ricochet had a match of the year contender.
That Gargano-Ciampa match where Gargano, like, tries to murder his former friend was extremely good.
Weirdly, the only match I would tell somebody to skip from that NXT TakeOver was the NXT title match.
Yeah, yeah, which was okay.
It had one really bad botch spot that kind of ruined the rest of the match, but yeah.
Yeah. No, almost every match on that card, fantastic. The Nikki Cross, Shayna Baszler match was incredible and had some great psychology. But I genuinely think, like, Gargano and Ciampa, that whole storyline and the way it's played out from DIY to now, I feel like that's something you could give someone who is into shonen manga but not into wrestling and be like, here, this is your bridge. It is the most shonen manga thing I've ever seen. But yeah, those are my two recs catching up from the past couple weeks. Matt, how about you? What have you been up to lately?
I have been spending a lot of time also catching up on wrestling since Heroes Con. I caught up on NXT TakeOver. I caught up on Money in the Bank. And I know I've been trying my best to keep my wrestling talk on my wrestling podcast, Smark of the Beast. All my wrestling talk is now on the Smark of the Beast Twitter account on Twitter. So go check out Smark Podcast if you want to hear me do wrestling talk on Twitter. But I do have to bring this up because we have to acknowledge the passing of an all-timer, Leon White, aka Big Van Vader, one of the best, maybe the best big man to ever do it in the wrestling ring. And I'm going to make a recommendation of a Vader match you should go watch. In fact, you could watch this whole event and really enjoy it. And that is the Great American Bash 1992.
I have written a retrospective on that for the Atomic Elbow Wrestling fanzine.
Most of the show is a tournament for the NWA World Tag Team Championship. The one singles match on the whole show is Big Van Vader versus Sting for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. And it is great. It's technically the first in a three-match series between Big Van Vader and Sting that would happen over the next 6 to 8 months. But it is a really good match. It's a great big man, smaller, tenacious wrestler kind of match. Really textbook in that way. And it has a lot of what was great about Vader in it. Without him, like, getting on the top rope and doing a moonsault, which he could do. So if you want to celebrate the life of Big Van Vader, you could do a lot worse than watching the 1992 Great American Bash.
Can I throw one out, Matt?
Please do.
The main event of Halloween Havoc 93. If you only ever knew Vader from his run in WWF, criminally underutilized, probably because Shawn Michaels didn't like him, by his own admission. But his WCW run and his stuff in Japan are incredible. And I remember watching, it's a Texas death match. It's the main event of Halloween Havoc 93. And it is bananas. It is 16 minutes of those two dudes just going as hard as they can. And highly entertaining. That event has...
You're talking about Cactus Jack.
Cactus Jack, yeah.
That's Vader and Cactus Jack.
Halloween Havoc 93 also has Dustin Rhodes versus Steve Austin, which you would not believe was Goldust and Stone Cold like 4 years later. It's amazing.
Steve Austin is also in the Great American Bash 1992 in a tag team with Rick Rude.
Yeah. Weird, right?
Wild.
Yeah. I was afraid of Vader when I was a child.
He was terrifying.
He's really terrifying. But in like a very cool way looking back. So definitely check some out. We're sad to hear of his passing. Great wrestler and one of the few who made it out into like the wider world of pop culture, thanks to his bizarre role on Boy Meets World.
That's right. Definitely go watch Halloween Havoc 93. See him spin the wheel and make the deal. It's great.
What a bad idea, and what a great match.
That's going to do it for our Checks and Recs. Chris, let's talk about some comics.
Let's do it.
You want to start with Man of Steel number 4, Chris?
Yes, I have not read it yet, but I do intend to.
Okay, this is actually a good opportunity, I think, to talk about Man of Steel, the entire series so far, because we talked about the first issue and how much we enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
The first issue of Man of Steel got a lot of stuff right, and Bendis hasn't exactly backpedaled into getting anything wrong, per se,
mm-hmm.
in his run. However, and issue two was really strong, too. Issue two had really good Doc Shaner art. Issues three and four also both had stellar art. Issue four, which we're talking about specifically here, had that good, good Kevin Maguire art. Hard to beat. But the stuff that we don't like, and we've been saying from the beginning that we don't like, has overtaken the book now. Issue four has become the Rogel Czar show.
Oof.
You know, a weird thing about it is it's trying to do these two concurrent plots, right? It's trying to do Rogel Czar, the guy who destroyed Krypton, coming to Earth to wipe out the last remnants of Krypton.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, I don't know if you read issue three, but issue three,
that was last week. I don't believe I did.
Okay. I won't spoil it for you, but issue three had a moment that I would suspect could be divisive.
Okay.
Among Superman fans. It's a story choice that is meant to evoke a reaction, and it does. But it feels maybe a little manipulative.
Well, you got to tell me what it is, Matt.
Okay. If you don't want to get spoiled on Man of Steel, skip ahead. Rogel Czar comes to Earth. And first thing he does, he goes to the Fortress of Solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And he just smashes the shit out of Kandor, the Bottle City of Kandor.
Oh boy. Like with all the little Supermans in it.
Yeah.
Just smashes it up.
Like he destroys the Bottle City of Kandor.
Okay.
Like that, you know, he's a bad guy. Boy, he's bad.
He's real, real bad. Smashed up that little city with all the little Supermans in it.
Issue three, by the way, had art by Ryan Sook, who's also fucking fantastic.
Yes.
But the sort of over-the-topness of the Rogel Czar story and how much I don't want it to be the story. Like, I don't care about the guy who destroyed Krypton. I don't want that to be the story. And how much I'm enjoying the sort of smaller Metropolis story about the series of arsons that's going on. Like, I can't believe how up and down my feelings on this book are.
What if it turns out that Rogel Czar – is that his name? I swear I cannot remember his name from one second to the next.
It's Rogel Czar. You got it.
Rogel Czar. What if it turns out that Rogel Czar is also just, like, setting fires?
Just like doing arsons around
town. He blew up Krypton. Like, he's full-on genocidal, but also he's like, I also like to set fires. I was like, this is in little fires.
Yeah, it's weird, man, because, like, you've got the arson story going on, but then Rogel Czar shows up and is, like, punching Superman through buildings. So, like, the whole fire situation seems a little less important.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I feel like the arson story, like I said, is worlds better than this, like, big cosmic story that's going on. Also, a weird thing that happens in issue four is, you remember the story from Action Comics 1000, where Superman goes through the coffee shop,
mm-hmm.
and he's fighting Rogel Zar.
Mm-hmm.
That happens in the middle of this single issue of Man of Steel.
Okay.
So, like, you see Rogel Zar, like, knock him around, and, like, he goes into the building, and then it, like, goes into a little interlude, and the story from Action Comics 1000 happens off-panel, and then it comes back, and, like, Green Lantern's talking to the lady who owns the shop, and the woman who she was talking to was talking about the red shorts.
Okay.
Which is not good or bad, I guess. It's just interesting. An interesting storytelling choice. I would love it. I would love this Bendis Superman stuff if it wasn't for the choice of making it about this guy who destroyed Krypton.
Does Rogel Zar at least, like, go into the Fortress of Solitude and go, like, I'm gonna smash up Krypton? Does he say that? Does he say that, those words, in that way?
No.
I'm gonna smash up Krypton! Because that's what he should do.
I mean, if he was kind of like a shitty redneck, it might at least add something. Instead, issue 5 ends with Rogel Zar asking Superman if he has children. Have you procreated with these soft earth creatures? He asks.
No, that really lives up to the John Byrne standard in a book called Man of Steel.
Yeah, Bendis is coming, guys.
Matt, you're better than that. You're better than that, Matt.
Look, he's done a mostly good job. If there was some way to cut Rogel Zar out of this Man of Steel series, it would be great.
Why? Right? Why? Why is this the story people want to tell about Superman? Why does anybody give a shit about Krypton?
It fucking beats me.
I don't get it. I've never been able to get it. Put the baby in the rocket and we're done. Goodbye.
Yeah, the baby goes in the rocket and the planet blows up and then it's gone forever.
Baby's in the rocket. Baby goes to Kansas. If Rogel Zar was like, I'm gonna destroy Kansas, and Superman had to stop him, I guess that would probably be like Kingdom Come, right? That's kind of the plot of Kingdom Come.
That's kind of the plot of Kingdom Come.
Yeah, but like, baby goes in the rocket, planet blows up, we're done.
It would be interesting if Rogel Zar was an alien who hated Kansas.
Do you think, Matt, we got 2 weeks before this is done.
Yeah.
Rogel Zar goes in the Phantom Zone, yes or no?
That is one solution.
Rogel Zar goes in the Phantom Zone and all the Kryptonians that are trapped in the Phantom Zone beat him up. Because he blew up Krypton.
And he smashed all those little Supermans.
He smashed all them little Supermans.
In the Bottle City of Kandor. Sure. That seems fine. I really hope it doesn't become one of those, Superman had to break his own rule.
Boy, if it does, then it's trash. I'll tell you right now.
We'll see.
I don't think it will be. Because, again, I don't think Bendis misunderstands Superman. I think that's evident. Like, he's kind of got Clark, right? He's kind of got Superman the guy.
I mean, I think that's why issue 4 doesn't feel as good as the other issues. Because there is no Clark. There is no Daily Planet. There is no regular Metropolis stuff. It's just a big fight with Rogel Zar. That's the whole issue.
I realize that, you know, they really want to bring some, like, new stuff and new eyes to those books. It is bananas to me that if I'm Brian Bendis, and I'm clearly not, and listen, if we're in competition, he won a long time ago. But if I'm Brian Bendis, I gotta know that, like, I would be great at writing Lex Luthor. Like, Lex Luthor is, like, the perfect bad guy for that dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, some of his best stuff was like, Ultimate Kingpin. Like, Kingpin stuff was really good.
For fear of being unintentionally insulting, he already looks like Lex Luthor. He's got it.
Oh, Matt, let's move on.
Okay. I don't think Chip Zdarsky looks like J. Jonah Jameson.
He could get there.
He could get there. But let's talk about Spectacular Spider-Man Annual Number 1, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Mike Allred. What a fun comic book.
I texted you, and I said, Matt, this comic is extremely your shit.
You know what makes it extra extremely my shit? And it's not just that it is a J. Jonah Jameson story. It's what Chip's Spectacular Spider-Man run has kind of secretly been from the get-go, which is, this is a newspaper story. This is a story about newspapers and newspaper publishing and, like, the battle for what is accurate and what is, and, like, good storytelling and knowing the facts. Like, you never think about Chip, or at least I don't all the time, and I think a lot of his comics fans don't think about Chip as a newspaper guy. But Chip is a newspaper guy.
Yeah, he's a newspaper guy. That was his job for quite some time.
He worked for the National Post, and it really shows in these comics.
Yeah. This is a story about newspapers. It's a J. Jonah Jameson-focused story. Spoiler warning, it has the Jameson Slayer in it.
Yeah.
Which is a spider slayer for J. Jonah Jameson, built by Arcade.
A Jameson Slayer comes to attack him at one point.
And at one point, he is getting an award, and he says, normally I would be over the moon like my son, the astronaut. Which I had to stop at that point in reading that, because that is – listeners of the show will know that any mention of J. Jonah Jameson's son, a hero astronaut, John Jameson, who is a werewolf, is delicious candy to you boys, Chris and Matt.
Yeah, it's the best. The best of the best.
Chip's phenomenal. Like, he's like, we've known Chip's good for a very long time. But I shot him, like, fan mail. Like, I shot him an email the other day that was just like, hey, Marvel 2-in-1's really fucking good. And that he's that good at writing the Fantastic Four and writing Spider-Man. And even as someone who was a huge, huge fan of Chip Zdarsky, not just as an artist, but as a writer and a comics creator, going back to, like, Monster Cops, even I have been surprised at how good he is at, you know, this annual. It's funny. It's got a lot of very funny moments. It's also a really good Spider-Man story. Marvel 2-in-1 is, like, straight up Marvel-ass comics, and they're phenomenally good.
Well, if I can get into my Matt Wilson suit for a second.
What were you wearing before?
I mean, a veneer of not caring.
Okay.
But I'm gonna care here. And I don't know how many people this story is meant to be for. I don't know if it's meant to be touching. But it's touching to me that these two newspaper editors / publishers who were competitors and kind of hate each other end up bonding by the end of the story and find common ground and find a way, you know, part of their rivalry was that they respected each other. And Jonah ends up, you know, deciding to help this guy who had a Jameson Slayer. You know? I found that weirdly touching. That these, like, hard-edged newspaper guys, you know, honestly really respected each other and were going to help each other in the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Again, the best Jonah Jameson stories are like that. But yeah, excellent, excellent work from Chip and Mike Allred.
Yeah, Mike Allred is also very good.
Mike Allred, who maybe draws my favorite Arcade since, like, 1974.
He's like a handsome Arcade.
Arcade's a good-looking guy, man.
Handsome Arcade.
My man builds all those death traps, stays out of the sun.
There's also a backup by Mike Drucker and Chris Bachalo that is, enjoyable in that, like, short Spider-Man, he's lost a bunch of people kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those. But I love those kind of stories. All right, Chris, that's going to do it for our comic segment. Let's talk to Katie Schenkel about the Cardboard Kingdom.
I would love to. Joining us for the program this week, we are very excited to welcome back a fantastic guest that we always enjoy talking to. She's formerly the writer of Moonlighters, but her latest project is being one of the many people who worked on the fantastic Cardboard Kingdom, which is out now from Knopf. Katie Schenkel is here. Katie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, guys.
I have a lot of questions about Cardboard Kingdom.
I'm not surprised. I think I remember last year when the first time I came on and I was talking about Moonlighters, and I think I kind of vaguely or offhandedly mentioned the creative process for Cardboard Kingdom, and you had said, wait, what? Could you go back and explain? And it was still so many months away. So I'm not surprised you have some questions.
I have craft questions. I have in-universe questions. I've got questions on how to pronounce the publisher and if I did it right.
I messed up for like 2 years. I believe it's Knopf, but because I know. Here's the thing. I am both of German descent and also took German. And I was like, it should be Knopf. And I found out after promoting the book on different podcasts, they're like, yeah, it's actually Knopf. This is why I went to, we're with Random House, which is the larger publisher. It was just easier for me to not get that wrong.
Well, you know what? I guess we can just talk about this book and all the Knights that are in it.
Right? Right? Trust me, I, as a both creative writer and copywriter, I got so mad about that. I had a rant.
Okay, so let's talk about Cardboard Kingdom, because it is out now. It is available for people to pick up, and they should. I read it this week, and I genuinely really loved it. This is the kind of book I would have read over and over again as a kid, and may end up reading over and over again as an adult.
Well, thank you.
Do you want to give the elevator pitch for anyone who missed it?
Sure. It's a graphic novel. It's sequential art about a neighborhood of kids who all know each other, and during the summer decide to create cardboard costumes in order to play and have adventures. And each of them kind of takes on a different alter ego. They make a character that kind of represents themselves and who they want to be. And it's all about how they turn their neighborhood into the Cardboard Kingdom of the title.
And it's really great because you see them as they're playing out the pretend stuff that they're doing. And that's all drawn in this very like straightforward kind of fantasy style. And then it shifts back into seeing them in their the cardboard costumes. And also that is all interweaved with their lives in a really cool way. I was unsurprisingly drawn to the story about the kid who obsesses over Batman while his parents are getting divorced.
Yeah.
That one hit pretty hard, Katie.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I don't think we've talked about this, and we will definitely get into it, but I co-wrote this with 10 other people, including our artist, Chad Sell, who was the one who came up with the concept. I think my story... and Michael Cole, who I believe is the writer on The Gargoyle.
Yes.
I think I've memorized off the top of my head whose is whose now. It took only 3 years, but I got it. But ours are really the most emotionally intense. Like our kids go through some really intense emotional issues, and I'm really glad that the book is sprinkled with like lighter things that like the kid who no one understands what his costume is and he's sad about it is up against the one where the kid is dealing with insomnia because he's become afraid of his dad when his dad comes by. I believe also back during our Comics Alliance days, I showed you a picture or one of the panels of his action figures, and you were very interested in those two action figures.
Well, one of them is an angry owl.
Yes. I want so badly for Michael to like write a little story about, is it like the sidekick? Is it a fellow, or is it the bad guy? I don't know, but I love the fact that he is just this like grumpy, muscular owl man. It's pretty great.
It is. But that, I guess, let's start there.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned co-writing it with so many people. Your story, which is Big Banshee, mm-hmm. Is very early in the book. And I had the question, how did it all come together? Because there is an actual overarching storyline that builds between each story. They all stand on their own. They're all very distinct chapters because they're all focused on one character or a couple of characters in yeah. a few cases. But they do build on each other. Like after your story, she is part of the group yeah. now. And so she appears in others. So was it a process of you got to write yours first and then people came after you? Was it sort of a writer's room deal?
Essentially, so what happened was, and I guess this will actually dig into the history. So Chad in spring of 2015 put out a talent like call or whatever. Like he wanted pitches for this project that he was doing. So the idea of the kids in cardboard costumes, and they deal with stuff they're going through, but some of them can be funnier, some can be more serious. So a lot of people, I think like over 100 people, like pitched to him these stories, and he had picked about 10 or so people. I think we had a couple people that ended up having time like issues and had to drop from the project, but largely he picked like the 10 of us. So after he had our concepts and we fine-tuned our original pitches to kind of make the most sense for the kind of book he was making, he then organized what would be the general order of the book. So my story coming towards the beginning was something that he had envisioned. And then the idea was, okay, you'll each write your draft of your script in order, and you'll know the characters that have come before, and those are the ones that you can kind of use in your story. So that's why the Huntress and the Beast, who show up or who are introduced in the chapter behind me, I was told like, okay, so use like these characters. You can use these characters as like in your story. And then essentially we all were in the same private Facebook group, and we had access to the same Google files. So we each got to, once the scripts started to come in, whenever our character was part of it, I mean, we could read whichever ones we wanted. We could, I read ones that Sophie wasn't involved in, but we were able to sign off on the scripts where our characters have dialogue and interact, and just to make sure that while Chad was the co-creator of all the characters and could sign off on it, we also got to say, yeah, that sounds like her, or no, I think that maybe she would do this instead. Could we adjust it? For the most part, everybody was very open and giving, and there were no egos about it. And honestly, once Chad started drawing it, it was just super cool to see, like for me, especially because it's so early in the book, to see Sophie get to show up even in the background of the other stories made me super happy all the time. That was very much a driving factor in my enthusiasm for the project, was getting to see her show up and having fun with all these other characters. So I think that's essentially was the writing process, was just slowly getting out these scripts and crafting it. I think Chad had a really good vision for the book, And some of this also came about once we got the book bought, our editors at Random House / Knopf were very good about then solidifying more of the process. So we actually had a few interludes and a few details from the book that really strengthened the flow that the editors brought in as suggestions, which now that I've read it, like from when we pitched the book, which was almost the whole thing was at least drafted out with quite a bit of the book having final art when we pitched it, because Chad was very adamant about putting as much of the book out as we could when we were trying to get it sold. But a lot of it ended up kind of getting slightly adjusted and changed. And I was really pleased with the editing from Knopf, because the book was just the best version of it went to the printer and the most cohesive, and there were a lot of interesting like plot ties that happened in the later editing process. So I guess the short answer is it took a village to make this book. I think that was Manuel Bentecourt who wrote the Prince chapter. I think was the one who came up with that phrasing. It took a village to make this kingdom.
I am fascinated by the fact that this book is, it's the opposite of what you see from every other comics anthology, where it, instead of, you know, maybe one or two writers and lots of artists working on different stories, it's individual writers working with the same artist on all the stories. I understand that Chad, it seems like Chad Sell wanted to have a very cohesive, consistent look to the book, but that's also a lot of work for him. And it also seems to make him the point person for bringing all these stories together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because we've had the opposite problem that a lot of creative teams in comics have, in that people forget that the writers did, like, that the writers existed on the book, and they point to Chad as like the sole creator, partially because his name's on the cover.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's funny because Chad, bless his heart, has been like, oh man, I feel so bad. I'm like, this happens all the time to artists in comics. If this happens to like the writers, I appreciate him always trying to go to bat for us, making sure we get recognition as well. But I was kind of like, it's almost darkly funny that we kind of get forgotten because you're the focal point of it compared to like comic writers now.
Yeah, speaking as a writer, I feel like we owe him one on this one.
Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah. So this is like the outlier. It was interesting because I think he's talked to me about this, that he was worried about being able, he didn't want to write this book on his own. He wanted to get those different voices. And I think he wanted that collaboration. Because he actually, so the other part of the story is that the first chapter is the sorceress, but he had created that chapter essentially several years before with Jay Fuller, one of our other collaborators, and he essentially just redid the that story for the first chapter, creating it more in the style of the kind of cartoony cardboard kingdom that he was working on for the book. But it was, but that had been a short story on its own. And so when he was thinking about expanding, I think he just didn't want to only have his point of view for it. And I think that it meant a lot to him to get a really wide variety of stories and points of view and voices to create the book. There's a lot to be said for his editing in the beginning of, or like for a good portion of our collaboration. He had a really good eye for the editing of the book. And yeah, but in terms of how much work he did so much work on this book. Because he also colored it and he lettered it himself, and we were cheering him along the whole time. So that ended up and making, you know, small changes and suggestions as we went as well. But yeah, a lot of it was just us being like, "Oh, Chad, this looks great! We're so excited for this new page." So yeah,
you brought up that first story, The Sorceress.
Yes,
and. As I was looking through this, I had a lot of thoughts as I was reading that first story in particular. I would love to hear what kind of discussions the group had about it, because it is such a, I don't know if I want to say risky, but it shows such confidence to make the first story in the book the one that doesn't have any dialogue.
Yeah, again, it's funny because that was what the short story was. There was no dialogue in the original short story. And if I recall correctly, we weren't going to have that chapter in it. The book was going to be essentially a sequel to that short story. So the sorceress and her sister and the knight next door were just going to be in the book. And I think fairly early on, as we were kind of looking at what the book would be like, myself and other creators said, I think we need the sorceress in this. I think we need that story. And like, it just doesn't work without starting with that. So I do think one of the strengths of the book, because we have a couple of dialogue-less chapters. We have quite a few pages that are just kind of are quiet vignettes. And then we also have one where we actually ended up for the Megalopolis chapter. That was actually used to be dialogue-less. And they decided to add a little bit of dialogue here and there to make it just a little clearer. But I think that one of the strengths of the book is that we have those chapters, but also that we did our best to keep the dialogue as tight as possible because we knew that kids were going to read it. And what I've noticed is that there are a lot of kids younger than the like 8 to 12 age group that the book is being marketed to that are actually reading the book because it's colorful and beautiful. And it's really easy for younger kids just kind of enjoy it for the visuals, even if they can't read as much of the actual book.
I love The Sorceress, by the way. She's fantastic. She's, I love she gets a costume change in that first story too.
Yeah, yeah. Like, she upgrades, you know? Once she decides that this is what she's going to do, she might as well go big. Yes. And then that big reveal with the garage door is so good. You can actually hear, like, the crescendo as it raises up. Yeah, Chad has a really good eye for layouts and for those moments, which I think is why like the dialogue-less scenes or the chapters work really well. He just has a really good sense of like comedic beats for those kinds of things. One of my favorite thing is also like I really really like the moment where you see that they put a headpiece on the cat.
Yes.
And the cat is not happy. She is not enjoying her dragon cosplay. And immediately sides up to the girl who's up for pets. Yeah, there are a lot of really good moments in that first chapter. And I think it's really indicative too of what one of the things that Chad really encouraged us is, you know, have a like soft resolution, but then put a twist on it. So the soft resolution in The Sorceress is, oh, the sorceress learns to embrace her, you know, who she is, and in front of the neighborhood girl. But the twist is they still tried to make the neighborhood girl be the damsel, and she's not having that. So she comes back as the arch enemy, which I think really you can see that same kind of story format in a lot of the other stories. Like, oh, the kid does something, but then something else happens and they have to react to it, which I really like. So like, things are never super simple. Like, there's never a super simple resolution to any of the chapters.
I really loved it when the sorceress comes back, because she's one of the few characters to get two stories. The lesson that she learns in that one is not that you shouldn't have an army of evil minions, but that you need to treat them as an alliance of evil instead.
Yes.
Which is extremely good.
Yeah, I can't remember if Chad had originally decided to do it. It might have been simply like, I think we need another story here, but I'm really, really happy with how that turned out. I was talking a few days ago about how, as a 30-something-year-old woman, granted, a childless 30-something-year-old woman, but I empathize with Jack's mom so much, because that is a hard, having the role of the mother of a child who wants to be an evil sorceress and is like making their little sister pull like paint up the stairs right before a date with like a dinner date with her boyfriend. That is a hard life. She goes through a lot to the point where when I'd seen the rough draft of like the page layout and we had seen like her boyfriend, I suggested to Chad, and the other writers agreed, that we needed to make him extra hunky, because that woman deserves a hunky boyfriend who makes cookies and accepts her gender fluid child. And I was just like, just give the woman some nice things, because she is a saint for putting up with some of the stuff that she has to in this book.
Yeah, and the happy ending of that story is she still goes and pours vinegar in the lemonade and stabs stuffed animals. Well, let's talk about your story in particular. Because you end up dealing with, is yours the second one in the book after the sorceress?
Third, because the huntress comes before.
Right, right. Yeah. So still pretty early in the book, and you go right into a recurring theme in this book, which is a complicated relationship with your family.
Yeah. Mine, I think Chad and I just tabled at A2CAF, which is in Ann Arbor. And so we did a lot of pitching of the book to like adults with children. So I've been saying a lot of the same things over and over and over again. But one of the things Chad has been saying when we talk about it is that, my chapter is really the first time that things get real in the book. So we have kind of this very sweet story of acceptance in the first story. The second one is like a little bit of family stuff, but also introducing the other characters, and it's a lot of jokes. And then mine is like a crisis of identity and dealing with gender roles and also like respectability politics. I remember writing it and going like, yeah, this is pretty intense. And considering that some of it is autobiographical, which like no one who knows me should be kind of surprised about. There was a lot that went into writing that. I think the original pitch was a little bit different. I had a completely different alter ego for her that was more superhero focused, but the idea was a little girl who was told that nice equals quiet, and her and her feeling like she had to kind of shrink away and hush up, and then finding an outlet to express herself and be as big as she wanted. And it meant a lot to me that we had decided to have Sophie be a little black girl. That was something actually pretty early on, went before Chad had officially picked me for part of the group. We had a phone conversation where he just wanted to hash out some more details and get to know me a little bit. And one of the things he said was, oh, one of the kind of sample characters that I had on the page that where I was taking applications, I was thinking about using her for your character Sophie. And it was a fairly different, he had tweaked the character designs and kind of what the style was going to be, but you could see on it was still like a prototype for what Sophie would become. And it just so happened to be like the one character on that pitch page that I was drawn to the most, just like generally while I was looking through the application process. So I went like, yeah, I definitely want, give her to me. I want her. Writing Sophie as a little black girl, like one of the things that was important to me because I am a white woman is to get to talk to black women, especially around my age who grew up at the same time, get feedback about the nuances that comes with being a louder girl of color. And again, the respectability politics of that. So it meant a lot to me to pull in a lot of my own childhood, but also recognize the ways that Sophie would deal with things in a way that I never would have had to as a kid either. And it means a lot to me that I get to give that story to little girls who are a little too loud now. Like, I know that I got to talk to some of them this weekend as they came up to the table. And when I was telling them about Sophie's story, they're like, oh yeah, like I talk a lot. And I'm like, me too. I have gotten emotional about this story ever since I've written it. So like for the last 3 years has been just me like getting emotional thinking about this story being out in the world.
Yeah, it is. It's, and I also love that the resolution to that one again is not like, hey, your grandma sucks.
Yeah.
it's your grandmother means well and wants what's best for you, but is also wrong.
Yeah. And one of the things Chad instilled in me is like, okay, she gets her confidence back, but what if that doesn't still work for the person who instigated this? You know, what if even after she saves the day, she still gets that disapproval from the person that she wanted to get approval from? That was a hard scene to write, let me tell you. I was like, oof, I'm so sorry. I'm making you feel so much like sadness and pain. We tried to make it so that her grandma isn't necessarily like an evil, wicked, bad guy, but it's complicated because family is complicated, and especially older family members are complicated. Just because they mean well doesn't mean that they're right. And I think it was one of the things I really like about my story, again, it's kind of spoiling a little bit, but it's fine. You'll still enjoy it if you haven't read it yet. But the fact that Sophie's mom validates her. And
yes.
I think that's a really good also example for parents too. I think there are a lot of really good examples for parents in this book where you don't know how to talk to your kids about some of this stuff. Well, here are examples of parents doing it well. I mean, Jack's mom really knocks it out of the park when she has this heart to heart with her kid. And I think that's going to be just as important. It's going to be important for like queer kids to see, but it's also going to be important for parents of queer kids to see. So they have kind of a blueprint of how to approach it.
All right. Now we've gotten to the part of the show where I just want to say something real quick, which is that why did the costumes look so good?
No, I've questioned that too.
They look super. I identified with Alice the Alchemist, who doesn't wear a costume and makes lemonade and then tells everybody that her lemonade is better than anything else they can make.
See, I've identified, besides Sophie, I've identified with, I believe, I don't know if we ever name him, but the Blob, Elijah, who just really wants to make this like super cool costume, and no one can tell what it is because he is the most realistic child in that he just made a gigantic blob out of cardboard. Yeah, one of the most unrealistic things about this is the fact that every child is really good at like constructing and like planning out costumes. It is very ridiculous. I mean, there is a part where just on the fly, I don't want to give away too much, but like the characters all within a few moments co-create this costume together. And I asked Chad multiple times, does this actually work or are we going too far? And I think at that point he was like, I'm okay with us tongue-in-cheeking this because why not? And I was like, okay, but also it feels it was so close to being too far for me and I let it go and I think it's fine. And I think it works as a nice gag, but I definitely was like, is this too much? Yeah, I am jealous of all of the kids like crafting abilities in this book. One of the things that I really am glad about, and I'm going to put on my promotional hat, is that we actually worked with, after the book's cover was released back in the fall, we actually got contacted by a paper craft designer who has graciously and enthusiastically worked with Chad to make printable how-tos to make the majority of the different costumes in the book. So kids do not have to worry about, oh, how am I going to make the costume just like Sophie, or how do I make one like the sorceress? We have you covered. We are trying to point as many parents and kids to the link so that they can download stuff and make the costumes themselves, because goodness knows I wouldn't be able to do it from scratch.
Well, that is good to know. Maybe I can finally get a good costume in here.
I've made quite a few of them, and I told people this weekend, if I can do it, you can do it, because I'm not very good with like handcrafts.
Well, I think that brings us to the part of the show where we see if our friends on Twitter have any questions for you. Matt, if our friends on Twitter want to get involved in these chats that we have each and every week here on War Ahead Ajax, how can they go about that?
It's a very simple process. Well, listener, dear listener, you got pushed in the kiddie pool. I can't believe it happened. What a tragedy. What a travesty. Your cardboard costume got all wet, got messed up. But it's just cardboard. You can make it again. You should do that. Put some creativity into it. Get one of those patterns if you need it. Make a new costume. Upgrade. Then, once you do that, sign up for an account on twitter.com. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific Time. After you follow Chris, he's at the ISB, or me at the Matt D. Wilson on Twitter, and wait for one of us to put out the call for questions, and you can ask a question of our guest, just like these questions you're about to hear for Katie Schenkel. And Katie, we're going to start with a question from Charlotte of Oz on Twitter, another member of the Comics Alliance diaspora. Charlotte asks, if a werewolf lands on the moon, what happens to both them and the moon?
I mean, I would assume that it would die from the extreme cold and lack of oxygen.
Fair enough.
kind of a bummer answer.
Yeah. I mean, but that's a... It's also kind of an easy answer, because then I don't have to think about the logistics of the transformation. That's why you gotta bring up whether he's wearing a space suit, Charlotte.
Well, since we don't have any questions from JJJ News,
yeah,
J. Jonah Jameson, I was going to bring up, what if the werewolf was hero astronaut John Jameson?
Yeah, so then that's a different story. Yeah, I think maybe the universe would invert on itself, and that's also a bummer answer. I apologize for that.
You just don't want any werewolves on the moon. You're against the whole idea of it. It seems
against it.
I gotta wonder then if maybe the real answer is we put all the werewolves on the moon, and then they can live as werewolves, and then we'd have a werewolf colony on the moon.
Now that I like.
Yeah, that's a little bit happier, I think.
It's they get to have a society.
Yeah.
All right, here's a question from Barely Sushi on Twitter, Mike Donahue, who asks, who has the more fearsome warriors, a cardboard kingdom or the Lego kingdom?
I mean, it's hard because the Lego kingdom is massive, whereas the cardboard kingdom is a little more condensed. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Here's the thing. I do think that Legos are more dangerous because, as you know, if you step on cardboard, you're not gonna feel a ton of pain, probably. Whereas stepping on a Lego is the worst.
So it'll ruin your day.
So I feel like I gotta lean towards the Legos, especially because, like, if you're a warrior in the Lego kingdom, you know that they're like training you to withstand all the Lego pain.
Here's a question from Asimov_fangirl on Twitter. Hi, everyone. Which is the best cardboard creation you have seen or done?
The ones I've done, again, promoting those paper crafts that I talked about. I believe and of course I don't have the link up because that would have been me thinking ahead. And Tacos, I think, on Twitter. Basically, if you go to at the cardboard K on Twitter or onto thecardboardkingdom.com, you should be able to get those paper crafts. And I've been able to create some really cool designs with those different paper crafts. So I think that's my answer. Like I said, I was not very crafty as a kid. So as a kid, I stuck to like the box becomes a car. And I know how to make this, so I tended to stick with like those things instead of being super ambitious.
Yeah, I gotta say, I never really got much beyond like cutting the mask off the back of the cereal box.
Yeah, yeah.
That's about as far as I ever got.
I would always get extremely frustrated with my cardboard swords because they were of poor quality. because they were cardboard and I am not crafty.
Yeah.
And then I would get monumentally jealous of the children of, let's say, 25 years in the future where you can just buy swords. Like toy swords. Like, those Nerf swords can take a beating.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting to me.
Katie, let us now quickly delve into what I call Character Corner. Mm-hmm. Portion of the War Rocket Ajax questions Twitter question segment where fictional characters ask some questions. This one's going to come from our friend and yours, Stone Cold HCC, an account that exists only to ask questions on War Rocket Ajax. Here's what Stone Cold asks. You think they're ever going to come out with the secret recipe for McNuggets?
No.
Like, make it available to the public, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think so. They gotta keep some secrets.
Yeah, keep it in the vault.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a good marriage. You gotta keep some of the electricity alive.
It's gonna stay in the recipe vault at Hamburger University forever.
Yeah.
Here's a question from another character. This is Lucky Jim 420. Lucky Jim Howlett.
I always forget them. Matt, I always forget them when they're not around.
Trying to make a deal with you, Katie?
Uh-oh.
Listen, Katie Bub. I'll give you a pack of Molson and I'll teach you my hair secret. If you change your name to Katie Snicked Bub, how about it?
I don't know what any of those words mean. So I don't know how to respond.
Very fair. More than fair, I would say.
I don't think Lucky Jim has a hair secret. I think Wolverine's hair is just like that.
Or like, have you heard this thing called hair gel? Yeah, I have. It's a well-known fact, yeah.
Wolverine's been alive a long time. I bet it's pomade.
Could be pomade.
Or natural viscous. And
yeah, I think his hair's just like that. I really do. We got a few other character questions, but I'm going to make this one the last one of the bunch. This is from Spam Ultron, who says, in all caps, do you think the gorillas could eat the guys from Oasis since Oasis aren't real? I think he meant Beat. Spam Ultron is trying to say, is gorillas better than Oasis?
I'm really disappointed, though, because I would have thought that Ultron would ask about the character of the robot from my hit-selling book, The Cardboard Kingdom, who is a little...
Yeah, do your research, Spam Ultron.
Yeah, this is more of me just going, like, if you haven't read the book yet, I think you're going to like her. She wants to destroy all the humans, and she has to learn how to make friends. And her dad is the, like, most adorable cinnamon roll in the whole book. Who somehow understands that his robot child just needs a good push in the right direction. It's adorable.
Those are the most supportive parents. It was
so good. Yeah, I really like those. And sorry, I'm going to jump into this because I just love it so much. But I love Connie's dad, and I love the fact that her mom doesn't quite get it, but like she's not unsupportive. She just doesn't quite. She's just not quite on the same like level. And I love the fact that her dad is super, like, soft and dorky, and the mom kind of has, like, the best cheekbones of anyone and is just, like, super, super pretty. I love that. I love that couple. Ultron, I don't remember what your question was, but go read The Robot in the Cardboard Kingdom. I do like Gorilla. If we're talking about the band, though, I do like Gorillaz. I don't know if that was...
Yeah, that's... Okay. That is what they meant. I probably should have made that clear from the
beginning. I don't know. I like gorillas, so...
Yeah. Better than Oasis. Yeah. I'm going to say better than Oasis. I said on Twitter this week I wanted to start a podcast about the band Gorillaz.
It's fascinating. I think as... Considering your guys' wheelhouse of both convoluted superheroes... And like in weird comic canon, and also wrestling, and like and meta. I feel like Gorillaz is right there.
Yeah, it's everything. Yeah. And
crossovers with the Powerpuff Girls now, apparently. So that's something.
That's true. I am having a very hard time talking myself out of doing this podcast about it. This one is on the fence of a fictional character or not. I don't think it's supposed to be. But this is a question that's asked to us from Thomas Aquinas.
Okay. I'm sorry, Marvel like Sumo. The saint?
Yeah, like the real guy. But look, the question, here's the question. In the hierarchy of monsters, where does the werewolf/vampire hybrid, as described in the Chronicles known as Underworld, rank?
I never saw that movie or those movies. Like, it was just never in my field of view. So I don't know how much I can say anything. I will say that, yeah, so I like the idea of, like, a werewolf-vampire hybrid. I like the idea of, like, a werewolf and vampire falling in love and then having, like, an adorable vampire child who also has problems with the full moon. Which, God, man, yeah, that's a really specific, like, special needs type, you know, medical situation. Because then, like, you have problems with the daytime, and then at nighttime, you have to worry about the moon. So, I don't know if I have a good answer, but I like the idea. I kind of want to write a character like that, where she just, it's like dietary restrictions, and being gluten-free at the same time. I don't think that answers the question, but now I'm intrigued by this.
Yeah, like would they be just like kind of a regular vampire when there's not a full moon, and then when there is a full moon, they turn into
a werewolf with like slightly sharper teeth, like the teeth get even sharper. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Which seems like it would be really inconvenient, and you'd have to kind of like work your life around this inconvenience.
You just have to look at the Farmer's Almanac all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. There has to be an app for that. Like, oh, there was definitely a full moon app for like werewolves. So like multiple.
Well, that's,
yeah.
That's handy.
Yeah.
Here's our last question. This is from Rankin Vilecast on Twitter.
Oh, I love them. I've been on their podcast, so.
They're very
good. Good fellas. They want to know, what's a better cardboard weapon? A cardboard halberd or a cardboard claymore?
Man, I wish I knew more about swords. Okay, so the claymore is like huge, right? Isn't it like really big?
Yeah.
And then the other, what was the first one?
The first one is a halberd, which is like it's a pole arm. It's like an axe on the end of a big long pole.
Okay, I think because here's the thing: unlike other actual weapons, cardboard is pretty light, so you could actually do a bigger, you know, as anybody who has seen cosplay at cons, like if it's from a lighter material, you can do a bigger one and have it still be easy to swing. Like the knight's sword in the Cardboard Kingdom is really like is almost the size of her body. So, but she's able to wield it. So I feel like because of the material that the claymore might have the better chance, because then it's sturdier too, so you have like the actual length of the and the width is a little bit wider, so I feel like that would have the advantage in terms of sturdiness and also just pure swing ability. Whereas with the first one you said that I keep forgetting, I feel like there wouldn't be as much stability there.
I think you're right. I think you've got it.
Now I want one. Now I want a giant old, like a Final Fantasy-esque giant sword made out of cardboard.
Well, one hopes.
Yeah, one hopes. This is the dream.
Then you will be able to find one. Maybe that's the next pattern that we get is for a giant sword.
We were able to figure out how to make Sophie's fists. So that's exciting. So it's not just you also get her big monster fist that you can make. So I'm very, I have been waiting for literal years to see children in cosplay or like, you know, in the costumes. So I am patiently waiting for kids to get to those sites and have their parents help them make these costumes and then put the pictures online. So, yeah, I'm very excited for that.
All right. Our guest has been Katie Schenkel. The book is called Cardboard Kingdom. It is available now at finer bookstores everywhere and online. Katie, before we get out of here, can you tell everyone where they can find you online?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Just Plain Tweets, or if you want to see my larger body work, you can go to katieschenkel.com. If you're in the Chicago area this summer, Chad and I are both local to Chicago, so we're going to be doing a few different events in the city, but the rest of our collaborators are scattered throughout the U.S. And if you go to thecardboardkingdom.com, we actually have an events calendar where you can see who's doing what, and hopefully there'll be an event near you and you can go say hello to one of my creator friends.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week.
I always love coming to War Rocket Ajax, so it was my pleasure.
Thanks once again to Katie Schenkel for joining us. Cardboard Kingdom is great, and you should read it. But we have asked all of our questions, and now it is the time that the question askers become the question asked.
Indeed! It's time to take a listener question from our Tumblr. This one is from Gary A. on Tumblr, who has a question that relates to what we were saying earlier about Man of Steel, Chris.
Okay.
Gary A. asks, why does Thor visiting Asgard work and Superman visiting Krypton not work?
I mean, because Asgard's still there.
I mean, that is the answer.
Yeah, well, because A, Asgard's still there. B, Thor's from Asgard. Like, if you really get down to it, like, we have young Thor stories and, like, stories of Thor growing up in Asgard, going back to Lee and Kirby.
Yeah,
so, like, I mean, it is established.
Thor grew into adulthood on Asgard.
Yeah.
Superman left Krypton as a baby.
Yeah, Superman grew up in Kansas. Superman could go back to Kansas as much as he wants. There was a time when he did it, like, every week, which was weird. But, you know, I would much rather see him go home to his actual home than to Krypton. And again, there are a lot of different perspectives on this. I've written about this before and how I'm, like, I have no connection to Krypton whatsoever as a reader, right? Like, I don't care. Because for me, Superman is he's human. He is human, specifically, like, from a farm. If you really need to get technical, from Kansas, he's, you know, an American guy from the Midwest. But a lot of people have mentioned that they have an affection for Krypton because they have a different relationship to the idea of an immigrant story than the one that I have, as someone who only, like, just South Carolina is where I grew up. So I don't have that, and I understand that there are different perspectives, but I also feel like a valuable thing about Superman is that Krypton is gone. You can't go back to it. It's not there. And he's never going to experience it, so instead he has Earth. And Earth is what shapes him.
Well, here's the other thing about it. If you wanted to use a character to tell a story about going back to Krypton or having nostalgic feelings about Krypton, you've got Supergirl.
Yeah, Supergirl's right there.
Because she was on Krypton until she was a teenager. So she remembers Krypton.
Yeah. And honestly, like, the Steve Orlando stuff about, like, you know, stuff that I had never considered before. Kara has an accent.
Yeah.
And no one can place it. And Kara has adoptive parents who tried to learn to speak Kryptonian, but the planet's been destroyed for 30 years and no one's quite sure how to say it. All that stuff is really good and I think really valuable through her character, but I don't think it works for Superman himself.
Like, if you immigrated to a country or from one place to another when you were a baby, you're not going to remember that place.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and all Superman knows about Krypton is what holograms of his dad, of Jor-El, told him. Right?
Which we should have never even had the holograms. We should have never had – the holograms are only there so that Superman is aware that he is from Krypton, as we as readers are aware that he is from Krypton. Anything more John Byrne gets a lot of shit, justifiably. But that dude had it spot on about Krypton. Jor-El shows up and goes, hey, you're from Krypton, peace out, and that's it. You're done. Superman gets to learn a little bit, but it's not his defining thing.
If you want to do a story about a character pining for Krypton or wanting to return to Krypton or remembering Krypton, that's a Supergirl story. That should be a Supergirl story.
Yeah, which the other thing is, right, to frame it as talking about, like, Krypton versus Asgard, because I do think there is kind of a connection there. The more you bring up Krypton, the more you reinforce the idea that Superman is an outsider, and he's not. The whole point of Superman is he's one of us if we had those powers, that we could be that, that there's not some kind of outer space nobility that comes from Krypton being a more advanced society. Like, he's not coming down to the noble savages of Earth. He's If a good dude got those powers, he'd be Superman.
Well, and I feel like the more you sort of put the Kryptonian into Superman, the more you get the kind of stories where it's like, can we trust Superman?
Yeah, which I hate.
Like, he's not even – he's an alien.
Yeah. With Thor, the more you take him back to Asgard, the more you reinforce the idea that he's a god, which is what makes him cool. The thing that makes Superman cool is that he's one of, like, that he's a, the good dude, right?
The good dude who can fly. Yeah.
The thing that makes Thor cool is that he's the god of thunder, and he has Hattie now.
Yeah, and he has these terrible family members who want to fuck with people on Earth, and he's like, hey, no, stop. You know?
Yeah. Like, Thor's... The reason we like Thor is because he is that, you know, like, super powerful dude who came down from somewhere, but he's, like, not as good as Superman. Like, he's Thor. He'll drink a lot and make mistakes.
And he had to live as a person as punishment.
Yeah. So the more you reinforce the idea that he's a god and he's an outsider, the more you embrace the fantasy aspects of his character. That's what makes him cool. I like it when Thor fights, like, I don't know, who's like an Earth guy that Thor fights?
The Absorbing Man.
The Absorbing Man, yeah. Thor fights the Absorbing Man, that's fun. Thor fights the Wrecking Crew, that's fun. I fucking love it when he fights Mangog and Thanos and the Midgard Serpent. That shit rules.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, I think that's going to do it for our listener question segment. Thank you for sending in that question, Gary. If you would like to send us a question, you can do that at our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also send us listener questions to our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also the place where you can send Every Story Ever lists, panel president lists. If you want to drop us a line, sponsor the show, just like we got sponsored on this episode by Rabbit Who Fights. You can let us know at that email address. Also, check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read comments, and leave comments and read show notes. I messed that up a little bit, but you get it. You can do all that at warrocketajax.com. That's also where you can find the links to the Every Story Ever and Panel President lists on Google Docs. Also, check us out on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast catcher you use. The more reviews we get on those apps, the more we are featured in those places, which would help us out and help you out as a listener of the show to be more of a part of a cool thing. So go rate the show if you can. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. For me, I've made it as easy as possible. All you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net and you can find links to all my stuff, my books, my comics, my other podcasts, and all my social medias. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find all of my stuff at the-isb.com. That has a link to everything I do. I really got to get the Apocrypals link up there. But you can follow it to the columns that I write, the other podcasts that I do all over the web. Before we get out of here, we like to direct our listeners to a good cause. You might have heard that that things are looking pretty rough these days out there.
Down at the border.
Down at the border. The best place that I have seen, the place that has come most highly recommended, is Races, R-A-I-C-E-S, which you can find at racestexas.org. That is the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services. They are doing a lot of work down at the border to help people out, people who are seeking asylum to get out of a terrible situation and are being met with some truly reprehensible things happening to them. We've talked a lot about Superman in this episode. We've talked a lot about Superman being a refugee in this episode. So if you need a comic book connection, there it is. But you can make a real difference by going to racestexas.org and chipping in a little or finding out how you can volunteer or help out down there monetarily or yourself. We would highly encourage you to do that because it's rough out there these days.
And since it is Pride Month, we are going to also point you to an LGBTQ organization that you can support. I am going to point you to the Ali Forney Center, which helps LGBTQ homeless young people get housing. So if you want to help make that happen, which is a very noble cause and something, you know, everybody deserves a place to live, you can go to Ali, A-L-I, Forney, F-O-R-N-E-Y, center.org. And help out that organization as well.
All right, that's it for episode 408 of War Rocket Ajax. Matt, I don't know. Did we do okay?
Something's coming through on the teletype.
I can hear you typing.
It's coming through. Bing! Oh, let me rip it off here.
Is this ASMR?
Okay. HQC, stop. S rank, stop. That's all it says, but I think we get the message.
Who sent that mysterious teletype to you, Matt?
You know, probably whoever sent that Skyrider a few weeks ago. We should probably investigate this.
Matt, maybe that could be an overarching. Maybe that could be an overarching mystery for us to solve on this podcast as we careen ever closer to episode 420.
Yes, 420, famously the number for solving mysteries.
It really depends, Matt. Have a great week, everybody.
We love you.
Yeah! Flash.